from the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. You're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Colleen Fox is the Chief Philanthropy Officer at the Providence Inland Northwest Foundation. A Spokane native who swore she'd someday leave town, Fox talks about the importance of building relationships and how her job consistently reveals the best side of individuals.
Morning, Andrew.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing very well. Sorry about that. I think I set up the invite from my phone and I must not have linked it to my Zoom app or something like that. But
no problem. I'm glad I jumped on and realized that it wasn't there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Yeah, good. Getting into summer mode, which is nice. So, yeah, how about you?
Well, the summer mode, I feel like I'm the cruise director now. You know, there's no more school activities, I guess there's some activities, but it's a different ballgame, right?
Yeah, I just sent our nanny and Richard the spreadsheet of the summer calendar of all the different camps and trying to get coordinated on who's driving who, when, and yeah, that's a whole other logistical challenge.
100%, 100%. We have a sick household right now, so.
Oh no.
Week one of camps not going so well.
That's terrible. People shouldn't have to be sick in the summer. In the winter, it's one thing, but
right.
It can be allowed during the summer.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is. I feel like everyone's been sick for like the last month. I'm ready. I'm ready for some boat time, Fox. Yeah. I need in my life. So
absolutely.
Well, very cool. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. As I mentioned before, here on the G Suite, we just love reconnecting with Zags and talking about their awesome journeys. And knowing you a little bit from working in the Graduate School of Business, and then obviously now our boys play on the same basketball team and seeing you around town, you're doing some pretty awesome things. So
thank you.
I want to talk about you, Colleen, if that's okay.
All right. I'll do my best.
So take me from the beginning. You're a Spokane woman from the get-go. So yeah, you grew up Ferris, you a Ferris kid?
Ferris High School, go Saxons.
Okay, go Saxons. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I can't believe I said that, but okay.
Feels good.
Yeah. So grew up on the South Hill. Mm-hmm. And I mean, tell me, were you involved in sports when you were younger, doing other stuff? What was going on?
You know, much to the disappointment of both my father and my brother, I wasn't super involved in sports. I was extremely tall. I was athletic, but I quit basketball when I was in eighth grade. Didn't have the interest, didn't have that competitive drive. I think my brother got it all. But I was a cheerleader in high school, was active in yearbook and honor society, volunteer work. So very engaged with high school.
Yeah. Well, I loved basketball and I played it. And I was like the tallest kid in fifth grade.
Yeah.
And then junior high came.
Yeah.
And then everyone else was way bigger. And same with football, same with pretty much everything. That's when I peaked, late fifth grade.
Yeah, I've been 5'10" since I was in eighth grade. So I was really tall growing up. But yeah, then I stopped. So
so were coaches like, we need you. We need you. Get on the team.
So this is a true story. And my brother truly was horrified. The varsity coach called me my freshman year and said, I'll put you on varsity. I'll guarantee you a spot. Just try out. And I just like, no, thank you. I'm good.
Ferris, I mean, Ferris basketball, that's a dynasty. That's a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Yeah. And by way of reference for folks listening, your brother is Sean Mallon.
Ferris, played at Gonzaga.
Mm-hmm. Played at GU. And
now coaches at Ferris. So he's come full circle.
That's right. He's the coach. I was going to say, what's he up to? But he's coaching at Ferris. So, wow. So cool. I had some cousins that went to Ferris, but I won't drop names right now. We'll play the name game. Did you go to Chase?
Chase Middle School.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Yeah. So that's what I call Deep South.
Deep South. Very deeply rooted in the South Hill of Spokane.
Up on top of the hill. But I know you live by me now and you're more Central South, so I can appreciate.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. And I was a Cataldo kid, so I know you guys.
Oh, you were? Okay. So yeah. And our kids are at Cataldo now. So.
Yeah, very, very cool. Okay, so going through high school and then Coming to Gonzaga, I think Sean's a couple years older, so I guess your brother was at Gonzaga. Did that draw you to Gonzaga? How did you?
No, Andrew.
Yeah.
I was hell-bent on not going to Gonzaga.
Okay.
I knew it was a great school. Obviously my brother had had a great experience, but growing up in Spokane and then having my brother be there, I thought there's no way. The only
Right.
reason I applied is because he was there. I got like the application fee waiver. So my mom's like, you're gonna apply, just do it. Yeah, I had no intention. I was looking at schools in Seattle, Portland, California. And then I had the experience of going on campus tours, and I had my number one school. I was ready to go, and I walked on campus, and it was one of those gut feelings. It's like, this is just not right. This isn't where I belong. This was perfect on paper, but it's not where I want to be.
Okay.
And so my brother took me to a couple classes with him at Gonzaga, and then I had a chance to go on the Gonzaga Experience Live, whatever that weekend is. And I
Right.
was like, dang it. This is 100% where I belong. It was just one of those true intuitive feelings that it was the right place for me. And it was. I have absolutely no regrets about my time there. So.
I think if you, I think like 90% of the people chose Gonzaga based on that gel weekend. Like,
Yeah.
and they don't, since COVID, they don't do it anymore. I don't know what the status is, but,
Yeah, it's just so hard. And I mean, that's one of my biggest pieces of advice for kids who are looking at schools. Like, you have to go on campus and you have to have as much of an authentic experience on campus as you can, because again, something can look perfect on paper and make sense logically, but there's something about the energy you pick up when you go to visit that's really unique.
100%. And I like how you just kind of trust your gut, right? It just feels right. We can try to articulate it, but there's something special about, I think, the community. And I say this all the time on this podcast, but I get a lot of credit from employers who come to me and say, I don't know what you're doing there, but your grads
You're
are
doing
awesome. Well
it.
done. Keep doing it. I'm like, I don't do anything. We get awesome students. And something about this place, a quality individual gravitates towards. So,
Well, I think the fact it's a teaching college was really important to me, and that it was small class sizes, and there was really an opportunity to know professors and have that engagement. I think that there's such a strong sense of community that it's kind of palpable when you're on campus. And then I think the fact that there is such a focus on service and developing full-rounded individuals, that I think that attracts a certain type of student, and really is kind of what makes it such a special place.
for sure, for sure. So you make the trip down the hill to
Yeah.
Logan. You're moving in, and what dorms you live in freshman year?
I lived in, oh my gosh, I'm completely okay. This is terrible, Andrew. I know it was the one that was across from DeSmet. What does that say about me as a human?
Welch. Was it
Welsh.
Welch?
I
Yeah,
was,
yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Welsh my first 2 years.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, no. Those are actually, they've been remodeled. They're pretty awesome now. Like
Are
they have some
they?
pretty awesome, what I would call suites, kind of
Yeah,
modern.
they were not that awesome when we were there, but we had a good time.
Was DJ DeSmet around back then? Where the third floor
No.
DeSmet on the corner, there's a they play music pretty much all the time. Well, maybe not in the night, but
Yeah.
and I don't know if you walked by and heard it.
Oh,
And
yeah. Yeah.
I asked students, I'm like, well, because I'm a grumpy old man a lot of the time,
Right. You're like,
so I'm
turn down the
like,
volume. Yeah.
yeah, well, I'm like, how do you know that someone wants to listen to Nirvana, right? I'm just trying to walk across campus. But I guess they have some sort of process where you submit requests and it goes on the playlist. That's what I've been told.
That's like old school when you used to call on the radio and make a request. That's exciting.
100%. I'm so glad. Wow. Calling in on the radio. Yeah. I used to do that all the time.
Yeah,
La
then you'd have to
Bamba.
wait for like an hour for your song to come on. It was very exciting.
Yeah. But even like in Spokane, small markets, I remember you get the actual DJ answering the phone
Yeah. Oh,
sometimes. Yeah.
yeah.
It's like,
Yeah.
sure, I'll do boom, like during commercial.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, well, total craziness. But okay, so on campus, and you did not major in business, even though this is a business
No,
podcast, but.
I'm honored that you'll have me on, because the ironic thing is I spent 9 years of my life in Jeppston, and do not have a degree from the School of Business. So,
You get an honorary degree for
yeah,
that,
thank
right?
you. I appreciate
Yeah.
that. Yeah, I was really practical at 18. I majored in history and political science.
Perfect. Follow what you love,
There are
right?
just so many jobs in those areas. I thought that would be really a good time for my education. But I worked all the way through school. I worked for the
Okay.
School of Business as an admissions assistant,
Oh, I
which
didn't
is how I
realize
got really involved with the Graduate School of Business.
that. Oh, I didn't realize that. So, and was that role in Jepson or was it over at Belchamp?
Yep, it was at the front desk at the Graduate School of Business.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. And that, because we staff that with graduate assistants now, but I didn't realize. Okay. And we have actually that's not, well, we now have a full-time woman who's wonderful. Her name's Margie that sits up there. But so okay, so I didn't realize that. Okay, so you're living in Jepson pretty
I'm
much.
living in Jepson, yes.
Okay. And then time to, I mean, did you go to Florence or anything fun like
I
that?
did Florence. So that was the bargain I made with myself for staying in Spokane was I was going to stay at Gonzaga, but I was doing the full year in Florence. And so that's I worked, two jobs through most of college so that I could do the Florence program and have that experience. So I spent my whole junior year in Florence, Italy, which was amazing.
So that's back when it was a full year, which
It was
was
a full
back
year.
when it was
Yeah.
real, if you ask me, Colleen.
It was the real deal. I know we have a whole gaggle of Gonzaga nannies who are helping raise our children. And a lot of them are studying abroad and they're all amazed that I got to go for a full year and spend Christmas and do the whole thing.
Right. Was Father Bruno around when you were there
No, unfortunately it
after
wasn't. It was
that?
past his time. I've met Father Bruno at many Florence gatherings, but unfortunately it was after his time.
Yeah, he was certainly a character. I'm a couple years older than you, so I did Florence in the full year, and it was quite the, now, were you guys in Antinori, or were you guys up at San Marco?
We were in Antinori.
You're in Antinori. Okay, so yeah, still old school, still original, you
Still the
know.
original. Yep.
So, and who was the director back then? Was it Burke?
Patrick Burke.
Yeah, great guy, great guy. Yeah, still, I think he still lives over there. He
I
might be
think so.
retired now. Yeah,
Yeah.
he had an Italian wife.
I think I heard that. Yeah. Yeah, he was
Yeah,
a
cool.
character.
And in typical Gonzaga fashion, one of his nephews is an adjunct and the other one's a full-time faculty in
I
my
see.
department. So
Oh, that's funny.
yeah, he's
My Gonzaga family.
for sure, 100%. So good, you did that, and that's back when you got to go to Oktoberfest, maybe a Christmas tour, and maybe did you guys go to Kilimanjaro or
I
Africa?
didn't. No, we didn't
Amazing.
go. No, we got
Yeah.
to go to Tunisia for the Christmas tour. And then actually, my
Whoa.
best friend's aunt lived in Paris. So after we finished the year, we went and spent a couple weeks in Paris with her, which was great.
Wow. Wow. That's awesome. Very cool. So come back, finish up. Now you're out in the real world. What happens next?
Okay, so I all the way through college, I actually did have a plan. I really thought I was going to go do my PhD in history. That was
Okay.
all the way through, that was my intention. And then I had this quarter life crisis moment where I finished my thesis senior year, first semester senior year, and realized there was absolutely no way I was going on to a doctorate program in history. I, had to do all the primary research and the source citing and lived in the library for months at a time. And I love history. I love the idea of teaching it, but the research component was just not where my heart was. So thankfully I did work, all through college. So I had some marketable skills. And I did all the Gonzaga treks. I went to San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, met with so many different people to try and figure out like, okay, what can I do with this, degree? And it was interesting. I mean, a lot of employers said, you can write, you can speak, you're a good communicator. We need those skills. And so it may not look exactly like what you thought it was, but there's lots of different places that you can plug in. And then I was really fortunate when I went to Seattle, one of my dad's friends agreed to meet me for coffee, and I had no idea what he did. Like I was like, oh, I'm gonna go meet with Doug. And he was the senior vice president of philanthropy for Seattle Children's. And
Awesome.
we were talking about, what I wanted to do and where I thought my strengths were. And I'll never forget, he just looked at me, he's like, okay, this is what you're gonna do. You're gonna come work in philanthropy. You have a passion for helping others. You don't want to do frontline service work. Like this is a perfect place for you to blend like that passion for making the world better and your people skills and your writing skills. And so he's like, this is what you're going to do. And I was like, okay, Doug. And his advice to me was go work for a university and get some training, go work for a small nonprofit and then kind of figure out what you want to do. So that really did sort of set the course of my professional career. I think I'm unique in the fact that most people in my industry kind of fall into it at some point, and I was much more intentional about kind of what I wanted to do. So I was getting ready to graduate, looking at different jobs. Again, absolutely convinced I was going to move out of Spokane. And then a position opened up in the Graduate School of Business doing marketing and recruiting.
We just
And
keep sucking you back
you
into
just, this is clearly where I'm meant to
the
be. And it was with the team that I'd worked with all through my undergraduate. Ginny Piskel was our director at the time and just a leader who I have so much respect for. So it was one of those things I couldn't pass it up. So I got to join that team and work for 4 years with graduate business students, and I loved it. It was the best first job I could have possibly wanted.
That's awesome. And Ginny was amazing.
Yep.
And so building some skill sets, and that's incredible. I actually know someone at Seattle Children's, which is an amazing, amazing organization. And then you finally get the opportunity to kind of maybe steer kind of closer to where you want to be. And I believe, now hold on a sec, was it Ronald McDonald House? Is that where you
Ronald
want to be?
McDonald House. So
Okay.
I was in my mid-20s and I was working full time, working on my graduate degree and planning a wedding. I think that was like the trifecta. And my fiance at the time, I still married him. He came home and he had joined the board for Ronald McDonald House. And he casually says to me, "You know, I was talking to the executive director and they need a full communications plan for this grant they're applying for. And I just told him you probably would be willing to do that for them." And I said, "Thanks, honey. I've been looking for more things to fill my schedule. I would love to do that." But I teased him. I mean, it was such a blessing, because I got to know that organization and the team, and I got to go through this whole process and stayed involved just in a volunteer capacity for a while. And then was feeling that itch for kind of like, what's the next step in my career? And I called the executive director and just said, "You know, if there's ever an opportunity, this is an organization I feel really passionately about, and I would love an opportunity to come join you." And in true small nonprofit fashion, they pieced together a job for me. So I came over, I was the, what was my title? Director of Development, I think was my title. And so it was really exciting because at that time, that organization was focused almost exclusively on fundraising events. So I got to come in and help build their annual giving, major gift, planned giving programs, and also got to do all the communications work. And then after I was there for about a year, I got to take over the events team too. So it was a perfect introduction to philanthropy where I got to literally do every single component of it.
Everything. And I by way of background, I'm an accountant, right? So like one skill set, that's not one of them, right? And I've been able to work with some folks in what we call advancement and development, I think is basically the same thing. What's the approach? What is it, relationship building? Is it, you don't walk up to someone and say, "Hey, can I have $10 million," right? Or whatever. It's
I've
the
never found that approach to be successful,
Yeah,
unfortunately.
right. So yeah. See, that's why I'd be like, let's just get to the point, right? I'm a number 10. That's it. You got money, I need it. How can we
Let's
solve this problem,
get
right?
down
So,
to
yeah,
business.
so.
No, I mean, I've gotten to, like I said, work in all different aspects of philanthropy. And there are some aspects, you know, direct mail, annual giving, it's a little bit more transactional. I send you an ask, you write a check and send it back in. You know, events, you go and you raise your paddle and everyone feels good. And there's really wonderful parts about all of it. And where I'm at in my career now, I focus mostly on individual donors, focused on major gifts and planned giving. And that I think is so rewarding because it really is relationship building. And I would say I'm kind of a matchmaker. I mean, a lot of my job is going out and getting to know donors and understand what they're passionate about, what they want to accomplish through their generosity, and then matching that with the needs that we have within our organization. And so that's a lot of it, is just creating those opportunities for people to invest in causes that are really important to them.
So you're probably like a really good listener, huh?
Yeah, so I always
Yes.
joke, I'm like a closet introvert, which people would never guess, but I really much prefer one-on-one conversation and I really love listening. So it's part of what I love of my job, is I just get to hold space for people to share their stories and tell me what's important to them.
Yeah, for sure. And there are some incredible people out there who are. I heard recently that the. When you give money, the same area of the brain is And don't use this with your donors head, because you'll see where I'm going.
I'm going to say Andrew said.
Well, the same way your brain is stimulated as if you're taking cocaine. So, but there is, I mean, and for people that do some pretty awesome stuff, I mean, I feel like the vast majority are like, hey, yeah, I'm never going to be able to spend all this. Let's do something cool and get
yeah.
some.
Yeah. I feel like when I first started, the ironic thing is like, I hate talking about money. I'm the weird person. Like if you go out to dinner, I just grab the bill. Like my husband will tell you, like, I have to drink wine when we talk about budget. Like I hate talking about money in my personal life. But when I first started, I had a mentor who said, you just have to remind yourself it's not about you. It's about, you know, you're asking on behalf of the organization that you're serving. And when I came to Providence, I got to sit down with Sister Rosalie Licati, who's our last working sister of Providence.
Wow.
And she said, no, 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 Colleen. She goes, that's wrong. She goes, you're not even asking on behalf of the organization. You're asking on behalf of the patients and the families whose lives are going to be better because of this. And then I'll never forget, we have a board member who is actually an accountant as well, really private, like very uncomfortable with the idea of fundraising. But she said, you know, I had a revelation that I love being able to give to things that are important to me. It makes me feel so good. And if I'm not giving other people that opportunity, I'm depriving them of the chance to feel what I feel when I'm able to give to something. And the longer that I'm in this work, the more I'm convinced that when we do it well, it not only benefits the organization and the patients or the clients, it really is the benefit to the donor to be able to make that connection and be able to give back and do something that's really meaningful for them.
100%, 100%. Wow, very well said. So when you're at Providence now, but at mm-hmm. Ronald McDonald House, which now correct me if I'm wrong, this organization, someone's having surgery, you get a place to kind of crash because surgery is expensive and all that.
Yep. Yeah, it provides lodging for kids and their families who are coming to Spokane for treatment, for medical treatment.
Okay, awesome. And right by the hospital, right by Shriners, I feel like.
Right across from Shriners, yep. And they just built a beautiful, beautiful house to be able to accommodate the increasing demand for
And obviously it's involved with McDonald's, has something to do with it. Maybe it's their
philanthropic. I would say it's like the greatest marketing coup ever for McDonald's. Yes. So a lot of people think it's fully funded by McDonald's. It's actually in our market, about 10% of funding came, and it was when you drive through the drive through at McDonald's and they ask you to round up or drop your change. It's remarkable how much that adds up.
I bet.
So that provides part of the operating expense for the house, but the rest of it comes from, you know, individual and corporate and community support.
And you started out kind of in this role and then did pretty much everything at the organization, it sounds like. And then eventually mm-hmm. you were president eventually, or CEO, or I don't know what the title
is. No, I was the director of development and communications.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So working there, getting more skills, building relationships, and then Providence comes calling at some point.
Yeah, it was quite a change to go from small nonprofit to healthcare. But I had been with Ronald McDonald House for about 5 years, and for a lot of reasons, it was just time for me to kind of think about what the next step in my career was going to look like. But I wasn't really actively looking. But I'm a big believer to do this work. You have to have a real passion for the organization you're working for and a connection to it. And so when I decided it was time to start looking, Providence was the first place that I looked. My husband and I think I mentioned Richard and I have 8-year-old twins who spent the first 3 weeks of their life in our neonatal intensive care unit.
Did not realize that.
And I had some pretty serious complications with my pregnancy and delivery. So I got to spend a couple weeks at Sacred Heart.
Oh, man.
And then 6 months after the twins were born, my dad was diagnosed with advanced heart failure and became a patient at the Heart Institute. So I had way more experience than I would have wanted. But in every single one of those cases, you know, what could have been just such a traumatic situation was one that I felt immense gratitude for. And it really drove home for me how fortunate we are to have the level of healthcare that we have in our community. And so again, kind of following that intuition and that gut, I just thought, well, that's some place I would like to work. And there was a position open as a philanthropy officer. So I came to Providence in the summer of 2018.
Oh, just right before COVID. Lucky you.
Right? Yeah, I've had really good timing.
Wow. And you're What's your role here at Providence? What's the
So I started as the I started as a philanthropy officer with a focus on the Heart Institute and some children's, because you can't keep me out of children's. And then in January of 2020, I stepped into the chief philanthropy officer role. So I'm now the chief philanthropy officer for all of Inland Northwest, so Spokane and Stevens counties.
Some do you get to travel a little bit and get to go
To
to
travel a little bit up to Colville,
yeah
yeah.
some of the corners and having been outside of town and my mother dates a guy from Colton and you meet a lot of these farmers in there.
Oh yeah.
They're wearing jeans and they're dirty, but they could be worth more money than
Oh yeah.
you could even imagine.
Yeah.
And they're like looking to help. So
Yeah, no,
it's
Colville is one of my very favorite places to visit. They're just the kindest, most salt of the earth people. So
I bet. Very cool. And that's your role still, just for the or not just, but for this area. Very cool.
it is, although next week, because I again need more things to do, I'm actually really honored. I'm stepping into an assistant vice president role for all of Eastern Washington and Montana. So I'll get to work more
Awesome.
closely with my colleagues in Walla Walla, Tri-Cities, Missoula, and Polson. So,
Awesome. And you said Polson, Montana, huh?
Polson, Montana. They have an amazing critical access hospital there.
Wow, I did not realize that. Wow. It's so probably a little more travel, but that's good. It's beautiful country. That's fantastic. And you get to get away from, let Richard take care of the twins
Yeah, I'm at
or
the point in my
whatever.
life where a night away in a hotel room with room service isn't like the worst thing in the world
I
every now and then. I don't want to do it all the
totally
time, but every now and then it's okay.
yeah, just 50% of the time. That's that's
Yes.
all I'm looking for. So, very cool. And I would imagine it's a pretty sizable foundation. I mean, and I don't to the extent you can talk about it. I mean, is there an endowment? How does that work?
Yeah, so our foundation, just for the Inland Northwest, we raise between $9 and $10 million a year. And then all that gets reinvested back into our Providence hospitals and clinics within our specific region. And then we do have about $30 million under management that allows us to continue to make investments. We have an endowment base with donors. So yeah, it's a pretty complex organization.
Absolutely, absolutely. I do know you have a great, I don't know what it's called. There's like a wine dinner at Arbor Crest, or there used to be.
Poor.
Yeah,
Yeah. Yeah. So
the
it's yes. So we used to do three big fundraising events. And when I applied for this position, I said, we're going down to one. We're not going to keep doing all these events. It's really time intensive. And everyone's like, okay, that's fine, but you have to keep the four. And then COVID hit and we couldn't do any events. And then somewhat controversially, what I found is we were raising more money and not having events. And so we've really switched strategies. We no longer do big fundraising events. We do some small kind of cultivation events where donors can just come and hear about what we're doing and the role of philanthropy. And we're raising more money, and I feel like we're building deeper relationships. So it's been sort of a shift in our strategy.
Yeah, and I think and maybe you can elaborate on this. And maybe it's COVID was an accelerator and changed things, but the models are different because, I've been on a board with Richard, the Alumni Association, before, and their big fundraiser was this big dinner every year, or being involved in other organizations or schools where there's an auction, tons of labor, tons of cost going into it. And at the end of the day, you're not netting a ton. So it's like, is it really worth it? And I feel like the paradigm had shifted, and maybe that was through COVID to more of a different approach. I don't know. And I don't, I mean, you came through COVID at Providence. I don't know if I'm right or
Yeah.
wrong, or if you can
No,
elaborate.
I think you're absolutely right. I think COVID challenged the assumption that events were kind of crucial to fundraising. And I still think events have a purpose. I think for small nonprofits that are newer, that are trying to get their name out there, they can be really important. I don't want to minimize that there's not strategic ways and reasons to use events. But what we found truly, like you said, when you look at the time, the cost, the labor, and then I always think of opportunity cost. I'm like, okay, what could those people have been doing that they're not doing because they're picking up auction items? And especially for a healthcare organization where what we do is really complicated. And it's really hard to get up on stage and talk about why it's so important to invest in healthcare. So we found a lot of times people would come to these events and they weren't even walking away really understanding what the needs were or what the cause was. And I think COVID definitely for a lot of nonprofits challenged us to rethink of that. And then I think just as our profession has gotten more strategic and more scientific, and when we start looking at things like ROI, there's just a kind of reckoning of the role that events play or don't play for an organization.
Right, right. And you probably don't have a typical day, but what's your typical day look like for you?
The good days that I enjoy the most are days where I have, you know, at least one or two meetings with donors. I mean, really, that's the primary purpose of my job, is to be out meeting with existing donors or new donors, sharing with them the impact their philanthropy has had, talking about what their interests are. So despite how busy things get, that always is a primary focus for me. I manage a team of 12. So a lot of what I do and a lot of what I enjoy too is meeting with the team.
That's a lot. 12 reports. That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot, but they're all wonderful. They're all wonderful. So a lot of what I do is trying to just help support them and their work, right, and help, you know, them navigate. There's a lot of meetings being a part of a large organization. I know you can understand there's always lots of meetings. Again, on the good days, part of my job is going and meeting with physicians and talking with them about kind of their needs, their vision for their departments, and then also working with them on grateful patients that they might have who might be interested in working with the foundation. So that's work that's kind of unique to healthcare that I really enjoy. That's typical. That's typical. And my husband would tell you that probably at least twice a week, my workday ends with a happy hour meeting. And I'm like, it's part of my job, Richard. I can't help it that the donors like to drink wine. It's just part of the job description. So
I have to go to lunch at Clinker Daggers and I have to go to happy hour tonight. I'm sorry.
It is a tough job, but somebody has to do it. So
totally get it. Totally get it. How are we using the funds in the foundation? Is it, I can't afford to, actually on my chart recently, I think my doctor's province, but I keep getting these emails like apply for finance, apply for assistance, or I don't know, like, is there a process where like, hey, I don't have the money to cover this or the insurance, and how does that
work? Yeah, I mean, our foundation provides a wide variety of supports for the hospital and for patients. So we're a nonprofit hospital. We always have been. We've been around for over 130 years. And part of that means that we take all patients regardless of their ability to pay. And not only do we take all patients, but they get the same level of service and care that, you know, a commercially insured patient would. And I think people don't realize that in Spokane, you know, our commercial payer mix is only about 27%. And in most cases, the hospital loses money on any patient that's not commercially insured just because of the cost of healthcare. So our foundation helps provide a lot of investment for new technology and new equipment that the hospital just can't fund through operations. We just were able to bring a new piece of technology called an ion robot to Sacred Heart, which is something that didn't exist in our region, and it's used for early detection in lung cancer. So it's a minimally invasive tool that they can go in and get really deep within the nodules of the lungs to detect lung cancer much earlier. We're seeing now detection at stage one, you know, that we would have not caught till stage three. So those kind of new innovative pieces of technology, a lot of what we fund through the foundation goes to those types of things. We fund a lot of programs, especially within the children's hospital, things like we have an arts and healing program that works with kids at the bedside, using visual arts, music to help them process the trauma of being hospitalized.
Right.
We have a full hospital-based school program that keeps kids engaged academically while they're going through treatment, things that you can't bill insurance for, but that we know are really important to the healing process for patients. And then we do provide a lot of patient assistance. We don't cover direct medical care, but we provide for things like gas cards for patients who truly getting to and from appointments is a barrier to access.
I bet.
Or hotel stays for patients, because we're a tertiary hospital and pull from the region. Sometimes people just need to be able to stay at a hotel close to their treatment. So a A lot of what we focus on with patient assistance is just making sure that patients have access to the care that they need.
For sure. You mentioned a little bit about Providence being around 130 years. Can you tell me about the history? I know there's some sisters from
I was a
somewhere.
history major. I love talking about the history. Yeah. I mean, I won't do it justice, and I could spend the whole hour talking about this, but yes. The Sisters of Providence came from Montreal, Canada. Our foundress mother, Emily Ganlin, was actually a very wealthy widow who, when her husband and children passed away, decided to devote her life to charity. And so she started the Sisters of Providence. And then Mother Joseph came to this part of the country back in the late 1800s and established the first hospital in Vancouver, Washington, and then sort of matriculated out throughout the inland Northwest. And came to Sacred Heart, but the Sisters of Providence, it was all directed by these women religious who came to this wild country and established schools and hospitals. And really, their focus was just on meeting the needs of the community. And I think it's fascinating. They have this lore about begging tours that they used to do. So from the very beginning, they relied on philanthropy. And Mother Joseph used to pick the pretty sisters, and she'd put them on horseback, and they'd go ride all throughout the inland Northwest into all the different mining towns, asking people to give what they could so that we could have health care in our region.
Wow,
And
going to the
there's
mining towns. That's good.
they'd
That's
go to the
good.
mining towns, and they would ask for money. And so that's always been part of our kind of DNA, is relying on the generosity of the community so that everyone can get the health care that they need.
And originally, what did they just give free services away?
Yeah, it was just free. And yeah, we had sisters who ran the hospital up until the late 1970s. Sister Peter Claver was the last sister who was the hospital administrator. And she was a force to be reckoned with. She was the one who actually built the current campus, the main medical center and the tower. And she was, yeah, we still have an award in her honor, and people still talk about her leadership. So.
Now there's that house that they've torn down now.
Mary's house.
And
And Providence didn't turn it down, let the record show.
the record, well, and I actually talked to someone who had been in there. They're like, it was an incredible house. But I believe the sister you're talking about was negotiating with the owner, and the woman who owned the house just wanted too much, and she's like, forget you, we're gonna build
We're
around.
going to build around you. Exactly. Those were two strong-headed women at that negotiation table. So, yeah.
Wow, it's always a unique setup for sure. Just a typical South Hill of that era house with a hospital around it and parking
Encircled,
lots.
yeah, by the medical center.
That's so crazy. Excuse me. You mentioned an Emily. I think there's an Emily's House. Isn't there like an Emily, or is there some part of Providence where there's like a retirement center named after Emily or
Emily
something?
Court, yeah.
Emily Court. That's it. Because my grandmother was there briefly before she went to hospice, but that's
Yeah,
right.
there's a lot of our buildings are named after sisters, so.
Yeah, awesome. And Providence is a big network. It's not just Spokane. I think
Yeah.
Seattle, you go to like Montana,
Yeah.
you go south. I mean, how is it, the West
We're
Coast or?
so Providence is the third largest Catholic health or third largest Catholic healthcare system in the country. So we span all the way from Alaska, Washington, Montana, Oregon, California, Texas, New Mexico.
Wow. You mentioned an education aspect. Did the sisters set up like Marycliffe or anything like that? They did. No, or other.
I don't think they were Marycliffe.
Okay.
It's been a lot of the schools that they opened have since closed. I just recently was one in Montana, but no, Marycliffe wasn't one of their schools.
Interesting. Well, and you have you Providence is in education, isn't there? Like the University of Great Falls or something like that.
There's the
That's
University of Providence in Great Falls.
where
That's
we is in Providence.
we still have the University of Providence, and we still have one high school down in California. But
Wow.
generally, Providence now has moved squarely into healthcare.
Wow. That's not your area of expertise right now. So, yeah, I believe in Great Falls, it's nursing. Is it largely nursing?
They do mostly nursing, yeah.
They should collaborate with Gonzaga. And my people are from Great Falls, so which we call
Oh, they
mediocre Falls.
are. Okay.
We call it okay falls or mediocre falls because there's it's a different place, but
Yeah. And we have so many people from Montana in at Providence in leadership. It's interesting. My people descend from North Dakota and Shodo, Montana. So
interesting.
yes. Well,
Yeah.
Spokane is the big city for us.
I know, yeah, I know. Montana's, I mean, an incredible th I rarely meet someone from Montana I don't like, so
Yeah, no, I always say that.
for sure. Do you know Scott O'Brien
I
over?
do know Scott O'Brien.
He's
Yes.
over, I forget his title, maybe
He's
COO or
he just
CS.
keeps yeah, keeps moving up. Yeah, Scott is our chief executive officer for Washington, Montana.
Okay. I was the reverend at his wedding.
No way. Him and Krista?
Yes, I
Oh.
know you could sense the presence of the Lord as we began
I
this.
could I don't
Yes.
know why I didn't assume that was the case, Andrew. That makes total
Yes.
sense.
Yeah, and I'm hesitant to say this because some of my more devout Catholic colleagues kind of don't laugh when I make these comments, but I am ordained in the Universal Life Church alongside Paul McCartney and Conan O'Brien.
Yes.
So,
Okay, so you know what's funny? So is Richard.
oh, awesome.
Yeah, Richard, which totally makes sense. You guys should start a business. Yeah, he married two of our good friends, and I'll never forget seeing his email, and he had all these emails from the Universal Church. I'm like, what is going on with him? Is he having some sort of spiritual awakening? And I was like, oh, that's what it was. But yeah, so you guys have that in common.
100%, and I still get those emails every on the anniversary of my ordination. I get a congratulations email. No,
Yeah.
I went to undergrad with Scott, and actually, and we've been family friends. He's from Portland originally,
Yeah.
but his dad and my uncle were really good friends, so I knew him kind of growing up. And yeah, when the opportunity came, they thought that I wouldn't screw it up too bad, and I don't think I did. So
That's great.
yeah,
Well,
we went through
they're
it. You may
both.
have been at the wedding. I don't know if you were at that wedding, but down at the
No,
Davenport. So.
I've known Scott for a while, and I got to know Krista when she moved to Spokane because she was working in philanthropy too. But no, he's another amazing leader. We have a lot of Gonzaga leaders within Providence. Our CFO graduated from Gonzaga. Our like big divisional chief philanthropy or chief financial officer graduated from Gonzaga. So we've got a strong Gonzaga presence within the organization.
I mean, it would make sense, right? Because I think
Yes.
some people that are drawn to Gonzaga are not just about bottom line and making money,
Drawn
about
to a
a higher
mission-based
purpose.
organization. Yeah.
And you have articulated a lot of that very well. What's your favorite part of the job? And you've kind of already answered that, maybe relationships, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I think it is building those relationships. And I'll never forget, I have this donor that I've been working with for years who's just an incredible person. And I get to see like all every day I get to work with these people who are just amazing and who reaffirm the goodness of humanity. But I remember when we closed her gift, she said, "Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity. Like, we're just so excited to be a part of this, and this is gonna be such a fun part of our, retirement and this kind of next chapter." I mean, to have those types of relationships with donors is just amazing. So that is really, really fulfilling. And then to see the impact and get to tell donors, because of we now have this new technology, or we were able to save this life, or we were able to ease the way for this patient. I tell our team all the time, like, what we do matters. And we're not at the bedside saving lives, but what we're able to provide and support saves lives. And I know not everyone gets to go to work every day and feel that impact. So I feel very, very privileged.
Awesome. Most challenging part of the job.
Oh my gosh. I think the most challenging thing is, I'm very driven and I'm very like, I want to be contributing. And in philanthropy, the reality is like, you're at the mercy of everyone else. Like, I can't make people be generous. And so, just feeding that ego and that control, and knowing that at the end of the day, you just have to trust in sort of the goodness of people. But it's hard to hold space for that and be okay with the fact that you can work really hard and still not have something come to fruition.
Right. You know, takes time, can take time. And it probably can happen fast when you don't expect it or take forever. So,
And the most meaningful gifts tend to take the most time, and you have to have patience, and you have to work at the pace of the donor. So, yeah.
okay. Now, this might be my most important question.
Okay.
Excluding Richard Fox and Sean Mallon, favorite Zag player?
Oh gosh, that is a hard question.
Men or women's, it can be either one.
Well, I don't know why that's such a hard question. And it's a hard question because I know so many of them on a personal level. So I'm not going to choose
Right.
any of the ones that like are friends. I grew up with Roni Turiaf, watching
Yes.
him as my brother was coming up. And he was such an exciting player to watch. And he was good to my brother. He was always really kind to our family. I mean, he'd always come and give me a hug and ask about my family. So he has a special place in my heart.
By all accounts, just a team player, loved the community, loved everybody.
Yep.
And I have not, and Roni was my, oh my gosh, I don't know what year he graduated, but I don't know how, maybe your brother is like a year or two behind me. Maybe we're this.
Sean graduated in 2006.
Okay, so I'm 03. So I had a little overlap with him. I remember after I graduated, Morrison was coming in.
Yeah.
I hear wonderful things about Killian Tilly too, who I've never
Oh,
met.
yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, tough. I know I'm throwing you some curveballs here. You're doing great,
Who's your
by the
favorite
way.
player? I'm
Oh
going to throw
gosh,
the
that's
question back at you.
okay, let me think about this for a sec here. My favorite Zag player. I've had a couple of students
Yeah.
this. So I'll probably lean Olynyk. He was in my very first class that I taught.
Oh, he was.
And just an extremely nice guy, smart guy, worked hard. He was about his school as much about basketball.
Yeah.
And I'm teaching him US tax, and he's Canadian, and it's already foreign for the Americans. And then, that's like even a double leap for people that don't grow up, at least with some kind of idea of how crazy
Right.
US tax is. And I probably shouldn't say this on the air, but I think my first exam I gave, like the average was, well, let me back up. I drafted the exam, and then I like at the last minute before I sent it to the printer, I sent it over to a colleague to see like if it was kind of looked good. And the response I got back was, it would take a student 4 hours to finish this. You got 75 minutes, right? Because I didn't want to,
My
and that
worst
was
nightmare.
what happened there was the guy next door to me, a finance prof, his first exam, the average was like a 98. And he's like, you don't want to do that. You can always curve them up. So I'm like, okay, full throttle, let's make this is like PhD level. So I cut it back, but the average came back. It was still too long, and it was like a 54.
My God.
And I had to curve it big time, and everyone was shocked. But I think particularly for him, now he was a tremendous student already, but I would imagine there's eligibility things going on. And
Right,
so,
right.
and then I remember him when he would walk into, same with who I did not have in class, but Chimick. When they walk in, they'd have to duck to get under the door. I mean, Richard might be pretty close to that too. I don't know how tall Richard is, but he's
Yeah.
no short guy. So, but yeah.
I remember meeting Kelly, and yeah, Richard's 7 feet tall, so I'm not usually overwhelmed by people's height, but I remember meeting Kelly and be like, whoa, he's tall. He is
Yeah.
tall even by my
Yeah.
standards.
They're just basketball players, are just big humans. I don't
Yeah.
know how they think of that well. I didn't know realize Richard was 7 foot tall, but yeah.
Yeah.
I like
Yeah.
to at practice, I like to show the kids pictures of him from college, like
Yeah.
dancing around and
Yeah.
doing different stuff.
Yeah.
I'm
My
like,
kids are like, oh my gosh, Dad, you were in great shape. What an athlete.
yeah.
They can't believe it. And they're like, you had hair.
Totally. And Jack's like, Dad, did you make that shot? He's like, yeah, of course I did. It was like a
Yeah.
picture of his shot, it's like that. So that's so funny. Well, you've done some cool things, and you've
Thank
had some
you.
experiences. And when you look back on kind of what you learned and what you've garnered over the years, and thinking about our students coming out of not just the business school but Gonzaga, what advice would you give to the newly minted Zag?
Well, I think for students who are still in it, okay, but I've got one philosophical and one really practical. I would say embrace the holistic nature of the Jesuit education because I really do think it's unique. And I think it positions students to be able to think critically and see the world and the complexity in the world in a really unique way. And as somebody who's now employed Gonzaga students and interns, there is something really special about the students who graduated with a Jesuit education. So I know we don't always love taking the Old Testament or taking all the things, but it really is. an advantage when you are out in the world. So I would say try to embrace that. Work on writing. Andrew, I can't find students who can write anymore. And I know with ChatGPT and AI and all these things, but I feel like writing is becoming a lost art. And I actually taught a marketing class and I had a student who was a really strong writer. And I said, you can write your own ticket. You are going to be so hireable because you have this really unique skill set. So don't only rely on ChatGPT, do some writing. It's an important skill set. And then I think as you get out in the world, I mean, just embrace the connections within the Gonzaga community. I mean, continue to build those relationships. I'm always so glad when students will reach out to me and ask, would you just meet me for coffee and talk about what you do and talk about career opportunities? Because I've never graduated from someone else, so I don't know what other alumni networks are, but I really feel like Gonzaga alumni want to support the upcoming students and the graduating students and want them to be successful. And I feel like that's such a unique advantage. That I would just encourage them to take every opportunity to take advantage of that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so true. And on that writing, I and this is no joke. I literally had an accounting firm partner, and I would say this is a top 10 firm, tell me that he would prefer now an English major with an accounting minor. That's how important writing is. And
Yeah.
his comment to me was, because I'm Jesuit educated, he was a Zeg,
Yeah.
I'm always the one that's reviewing that stuff that's going external at a high level.
Yeah.
So yeah, I
Yeah.
mean it's 100% true. So well, awesome. Well, thank you for joining
Thank you for
me
having
us
me.
today.
Yeah.
Super appreciate it, and I'll let you get back for the rest of your day.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Andrew. Have a good rest of your day.
Yeah,
Thanks.
cheers.
Bye.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire, and go Zags.